Welcome to podcast number 44 of My Favorite Detective Stories. Today's date is April 2nd, 2019, and I'm your host, John A. Hoda. Our guest this week is Douglas Haas. Doug has over 50 years of investigative experience, including 30 years in law enforcement and 20 years as a private investigator. He was the director of the Federal, State, and Local Organized Crime Task Force for 10 years. He was also the director of the Broward Sheriff's Office Department of Organized Crime and is a retired captain from the Fort Lauderdale Police Department. He has an expertise in complex investigations, police procedures, interrogation and interview techniques, terrorism, and homicide investigations. As a private investigator, Mr. Haas has been engaged by defense attorneys and clients to assist their defense teams in both federal and state cases. He has successfully directed the defense in homicide, narcotics, and complex fraud investigations. He has conducted criminal and civil investigations throughout the United States, Europe, and Canada. It is my pleasure to introduce Douglas Haas. My Favorite Detective Stories podcast features past or present detectives and investigative journalists. As a working investigator of over 42 years, I hope to inform, inspire, and entertain you with great stories. We want to learn from our guests how they got started in the field and why they decided to become investigators in the first place. Listen as they tell us about the early years and who were their mentors and why those mentors had such a huge impact on their careers. We'll explore what makes for a good investigator and what makes for good investigation. But most importantly, after you get to know our guests, we will ask them for their favorite detective story, or maybe two. Stay tuned. The interview is about to begin. Hi, Doug. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, you're quite welcome, sir. And how is the weather up in the Granite State?
Oh, man, somebody ought to put a bullet in my head. I moved here from Texas. A short time in Pensacola, Florida, and this is my first full winter, and I have a Ford Mustang convertible, which has never seen snow before, and it's not talking to me these days, that's for sure.
No, the rear-wheel drive just doesn't get up those hills. No. Anyway, I'm sorry to hear that. Today is actually a 50-degree day down here in southern New England.
Yeah, it's that here up here too. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So we're getting you're getting ready for your first mud season. So yeah.
Hopefully I'll get a case to take me out to California.
That's what you need. So as we record this, today is March the 15th, 2019, and it's a little late in the afternoon, but we survived the tech gremlins, and we are now talking, so that's fantastic. So, hey, when my guests come on the show, I always ask them first thing, what is it that you do that you tell people?
Well, it's funny you ask that, because I was working with an author not too far from where you live. And he sent me a list of questions about PIs. And he asked me, how do I introduce myself to people? What do I say? And I just tell them I'm a private investigator. And and if the conversation goes further, I tell them that I specialize in interviewing people. And I explain to them what PIs actually do. We get information for them, and there's only certain ways to get information. One is to interviews, the other is research, and the other is surveillance. Mm-hmm. Basically, that's what we do, and I tell them that. And I said, the difference between what I did when I was in law enforcement, because it usually, once you tell somebody you're a private investigator, the most common thing they say is, oh, I've always wanted to do that. Especially when you're talking to females. I've always wanted to do that. And so then you have an opening. And they said, well, I asked them what interests them in PI work. And a lot of it, they get it from TV, but a lot of it is they realize that private investigators get information. And that intrigues a lot of people. And so the conversation goes from there. And the next common thing that you come across, and I find this a problem, is they equate private investigators with divorces.
Yep.
And with 50% of the society are divorced in America, you know a percentage of those people you're talking to have had a PI get in their way in their divorce. So you got to be careful. And I tell them I really don't work a lot of domestic divorces. What I work, though, is child custody cases. And then later on in the conversation, I'll tell them, you know, my specialty is interviewing people. That I can hire people to do surveillances. I can hire people to do research. But I have to have a really good investigator that knows how to interview, because you oftentimes have to testify in court. And getting information from people is for a lot of people is very difficult. And I for some reason fell into it when I became a detective. And I'll tell you that story later. But when I was in law enforcement, and I just increased my ability to get people to talk to me. And, you know, as you know, when you hire people to help you, you know, you can get people to do surveillances, you can get people to do the research, but like I said, it's hard to get people to know how to do interviews.
Oh, you're right.
So I stress that with them, and I tell them, look, you know, you have to get people to talk to you, and that's where you're going to get the break in your case. And you can use all the forensics you want, but you have to apply those forensics with the people you're dealing with and get them to corroborate what the forensics shows. So it's all good. It's a lot of fun. And that's what I tell them. I'm a private investigator.
So I think maybe sometimes the third answer is, and I feel like we're doing Family Feud here, but the survey says is that I'll tell someone that I'm a private investigator, and then a little bit later they'll say, well, in a joking way, are you following me?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And now my reply, and you can steal this from me or swipe this from me if you want, is I'll say, no, I'm not following you right now. But that 1998 tax return looks a little funky, don't you think? And I do it with sort of a coy smile on my face. But
well, you know, the thing is that one of the ways you get people to talk to you is they think you know more than you do, and you certainly don't want to disavow them of that.
No. Second thing I wanted to mention in listening to what you said about interviewing is that I made that my avocation within my profession going back to my earliest days. I took a college course on interviewing, and it was in a sociology book that a criminal justice professor was using to teach what then was being done by sociologists and psychologists as part of their interviewing regimens. We didn't have anything like that back in the early 70s. And from that time forward, I just always gravitated towards the courses or the teachings or the books that were related to investigative interviewing. And you're right, it's an art form. And done well, it can open up doors. Done wrong, you get the door slammed in your face. So,
you know, I was contacted by a former CNN news personality, and she was a reporter, and her father was murdered, and she found his body when she was 8 years old.
Oh my Lord.
Yeah. And, she lived with that her whole life, and the guy that did it got off, and, she got the OWN network to talk about doing a series on it. And she brought me on board to be the investigator. And what had happened, and this goes to the interviews, a police investigator from a small department in South Florida had gone out to interview this guy in North Carolina. And the guy had told somebody that he had been involved in it. And of course, he gets there. The local police department helped him set it up. He brings the guy in, sits down, reads the guy his rights. And the investigator's sitting there with all sorts of files and books in front of him. The guy's sitting there. The guy's nervous as can be. Body language is he's ready to say whatever he has to say. And the investigator, after he reads him his right, he says, if you admit to this, we're going to give you immunity.
What?
Yeah. And I'm watching this whole preamble, and I'm saying, this guy's going to go so easy. He is so nervous. You just got to open him up a little bit, and he's gonna talk. And he offers him immunity without even trying to break him. And of course, the prosecutors can't prosecute the guy because everything he said was done under the guise of immunity. And it became a real battle. So, like you said, a bad interview can really screw you up.
Oh, my Lord. Now, just to ask the silly question, did he confess when he had the immunity?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, in a case like that, your client, the daughter, is going to get closure, but not justice.
Right. She felt that she didn't get either. And the project dropped because the network was afraid that she was going to be out for vengeance.
So, yeah.
It was interesting. I learned a lot from it. But you know, I mean, I certainly would have handled it. I know you would have handled it differently. But that, you know, look, I have other investigators that bring me in to help them do an interview. I mean, it's not, you know, the biggest strength that I see in good investigators is they know their limitations. And friends of mine that I work with say, can you come along and help me with this?
Sure. They've seen you in action, and they know the difference between what they don't know that you know. And they at least recognize that, and they put their ego to the back seat and let you do the driving. So, yeah. But you had to start somewhere with this. So when did your career start, and how did interviewing become an important part of it?
You know, I started in the Fort Lauderdale Police Department as a patrolman in February 1968. And, you know, street cop, and I was fortunate enough to have really good partners that knew how to talk to people and knew how to get the most out of people without getting them angry. You know, it's just amazing. I lucked out. And so I watched them and I learned that you gotta get people to talk to you. And there's a lot of different ways. And then I was a motorman, and we worked accidents. And the accidents taught me how to collect evidence and put together, you know, recreate the accident. And it was a good primer for being a detective.
Sure.
I was on motors, and I got in a really bad accident. I T-boned a woman at 65 miles an hour.
Mm.
And so I got back on the road. After about 6 months, and I got in a high speed chase on my motorcycle, and I decided that was enough. And they asked me if I wanted to be a detective, and so I did. And back then, you know, you worked with a partner, and you were assigned a squad. And I lucked out because I had a sergeant. His name was Brian Brooks, and he was a really mellow guy. And he said, Doug, he said, the key to being a good detective is to learn how to interview people. What I want you to do is I want you to watch Ed Sweeney, who was a detective. He was a former New York City police officer. And he said, he's the best interview we had. And just watch his interviews and learn from it. And then to do that for a couple of days. And then I'm not going to give you any cases. What I want you to do is go through the stack of new cases that come in and pull, if the guy's in custody, pull him and talk to him. And just learn how to talk to them, learn what makes them tick. Just, you know, listen, don't just ask him questions, but watch Ed, watch how he does it, and develop your own style. So I did that. I did that for a week. Every day I'd go pull a prisoner, I'd sit him down, and I'd talk to him at length and realize that, you know, number one, you got to listen. Number two, you can't be condescending. And number three, you got to be a little empathetic. You don't have to raise your voice. You don't have to do anything. Just get them talking and keep them talking until you find common ground. And so the second week I come in and I pull this guy. He was a bad check writer. And I pull him out, and he fesses up to writing about 20 bad checks. And we got along. And so I said, what do you want to eat? I'm going to Burger King. He says, you know, Whopper with cheese, fries, and a strawberry milkshake. And okay, stay here. I'll be right back. I'll get him. We sit there. We eat lunch together. Talk a little bit more. And I'm walking him back to the cell. And he said, look, he says, you're a nice guy. He says, I'm wanted under another name. I said, no kidding. What's that? He gives me the name. I go up to record. Sure enough, he's wanted under another name. So next day I pull him out and we go through the same thing. He confesses to a bunch of checks and I go get him a Whopper with cheese, fries, and strawberry shake. Take him back. As we're on our way back to the cell, he says, look, I'm wanted under another name. So by Thursday, I cleared up four warrants and hundreds of bad checks with this guy. And I'm taking him back to his cell and he stops. I said, don't tell me, dude, it's Friday. Don't tell me you're wanted under. And he says, no, you got it all. He says, but the night before I was arrested, I was in a craps game with a guy by the name of Knight, who was on the 10 most wanted list of the FBI for murdering a banker in an extortion attempt. And he murdered the banker and shot the banker's wife. And this is a really bad guy. He says, I could take you right to him. And I said, yeah, hold that thought. We go back to the interview room and we call the FBI and they come in, went out and got the guy. And that's when I really, really appreciated the power of interviewing. Because it wasn't hard work. I mean, you had to be patient, but there was no heavy lifting. And from that experience as a larceny, I was working larceny, which outside of homicide was my favorite squad. And so I just started honing my skills. I watched other detectives that knew how to get people to talk. We had this one guy, Herbie Grounds. He was great. Herbie had to be 450 pounds. He was 6'5", huge guy from Georgia. And just a really nice guy.
And how do you say his last name again?
Grounds, G-R-O-U-N-D-S. I think he's passed away. Right. But Herbie was my partner for a while in homicide. And back then it was robbery homicide, and then they split him up shortly after this. But Herbie, we get this guy that did a series of drugstore robberies. He did like 20 drugstore robberies when DeLaden was a big thing. And we picked the kid up and we got him in the interrogation room and we're listening. We didn't have video set up back then. We're in a listening room and listening to Herbie. And Herbie tells the kid, he says, what's your name? Where are you from? And the kid says, I'm from Gadsden, Georgia. Gadsden, Georgia, you're kidding me. He said, no. He said, my cousin owns the, he hesitated. The kid said, the Ford dealership? He said, yeah, the Ford. That's my cousin that owns that. He said, holy cow, what a small world. And they're talking all this stuff about, you know, rural Georgia and everything. And then the kid says, hey, you know, you're nice. I'm going to tell you what happened. And the kid confesses to everything. So we send the kid's girlfriend in after Herbie leaves to talk to, she wanted to talk to him, and Herbie said they'd let it happen. So we send her, he said, I told the detective everything. She says, what are you, crazy? He said, he was such a nice guy. And besides, his uncle so-and-so runs the Ford dealership in Gadsden. So, you know, we're laughing, and we hide it up, we book him. And I said, do you really know that guy? He said, no, but every rural town has a Ford truck dealership and every kid knows who runs it. And I just threw it out there. He actually answered his own questions. So, you know, stuff like that, you know, it's priceless. Sure. You know, I used that ploy so many times and, you know, to get them, you know, Ed Sweeney, when he would go into an interview, it would be a heinous homicide. And he'd talk about anything but the homicide. I mean, he'd find out what, you know, what sport they like, what team they like, and he'd spend a half hour talking Yankees baseball. And, you know, and the kid is going along, and next thing you know, the kid's spilling his guts about a terrible murder he did. You know?
Yeah.
And so I was lucky. I had good mentors, and I'll give you a pivotal moment, though, that really defined my style, that taught me a big lesson. Is we put out, when I was running the Organized Crime Task Force of South Florida, as a federal, state, and local task force, and we only worked the mafia. And that's where I met Rory McMahon, who you've had on your show.
Yes.
Rory and I, he was on probation, and we worked really closely with him. And we put on a Canadian racketeering conference, and we put it on in February, so we'd get a lot of people from Canada, because Canada had a lot of mobsters that lived in Florida.
Mm.
So when we wanted to get these guys down there and establish relationships, so we, you know, the conference cost them $100, and we put them up at a big resort in February in a Fort Lauderdale beach. You know, you couldn't get, I think we had like 175 people show up to that thing. So anyway, one of the guest speakers was this guy from, I think it was Saskatchewan, Canada. Great big guy. I mean, not heavy, but a big guy. Mm-hmm. And it's shocking, head of white hair and a big white mustache. And his eyebrows, I'll never forget it. They were thick as Mark Twain's, right?
Okay.
And so he's up there, and he walks on the stage. And you can use this when you give a speech. I use this all the time. He comes up there. Now, we had a hospitality center set up, right? Every night, it was stocked with free booze and people. It was great. So he gets up there, and he has a book in his hand with a piece of paper wrapped around it. It looked like a Bible, and he raises it. He said, I want everybody to stand. And, you know, he was striking appearance, but he had this really deep voice. I want everybody to stand, and he's holding the book up in there. Everybody stands. And he goes, I want to ask forgiveness for all the drunkenness and debauchery that's gone on last night in the hospitality center. And I want to apologize for it, but I also want to apologize to you guys, because the only way I can get people to stand up in a room when I enter is to do this. And we realized we had been had. But what that showed me was people, by and large, want to cooperate. It's in our human nature to cooperate. And if you present yourself as the type of person they can talk to, they're going to cooperate with you. And I've done this a couple times. Sun Sentinel in Fort Lauderdale has, every other year, they have a writers conference, and people from all over the world come to it. The first year I did it, they had 700 people show up.
Hmm.
And I did a lecture on how to do the difficult interview. Now, these are all writers, newspaper people, and electronic media people from around the world, right?
Okay.
Now, most of them are pretty liberal. So I got a book that looked like a Bible. I wrapped it in paper, and so they couldn't see it, and I do the same thing. I hold it up, and I start preaching brimstone and fire, and then I lay the punchline down. This is the only way I can get you all to stand up for me whenever. They went berserk. Mm. They just thought it was the funniest thing in the world. And that's how I started off my lecture. When you go into an interview, you have to think that that person's going to like you and they're going to talk to you.
Sure.
And so anyway, that's it.
No, that's great. I mean, and a lot of the things that you said there, you first talked about your partners when you were on the street in uniform. And we both know, even to this day, in this enlightened age, there are still a lot of guys and gals who are badge heavy. They just, yeah. And we know what that term means. And that means that they talk behind the aviator glasses down at the individual.
Yeah.
And they just think that the person is always lying to them, or that everybody is always lying to them. And it's such a situation where it just abbreviates what could be a simple fact gathering. Or,
yeah.
In that they say to the person, well, this is what happened, and I know it. Don't worry about it. You know, thanks a lot. And they just poo-poo witnesses who years later could have been pivotal in the case.
Oh, God, it's amazing.
Yeah. So that sort of stuff still prevails. Oh, I mean,
yeah.
And the thing is, the sad thing about this was you went through a police academy. I went through a police academy, and we spent more time on the motor vehicle code than we did on interviewing people, which is the most important skill in law enforcement, right?
Law enforcement, there are zero courses in communication for police officers. The most powerful weapon in a police officer's arsenal is his or her mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Period. It can get you killed, or it can save you.
Right.
The FBI did a survey on people who shot and killed cops, and people who could have shot the cop but didn't. And the common denominator for the guys that had the drop on the cop and didn't pull the trigger was the cop was nice to them before, and he didn't have the heart to do it.
How about that?
This one guy, I read the report, and this one guy said, they asked him, you know, what happens? Well, the cop stops me. I'm walking down the street, and he was a really nice guy. And I had a gun on me, and, I ran, and, he catches up to me. We get in a struggle. I get his gun away from him. I got his gun and my gun pointed at him, and I didn't shoot him. I said, why? I said, because he was so nice to me when he stopped me. I didn't have the heart to do it. So, you know, I mean, unless you're a sociopath, those things play out. When I was a young cop, I'll give you a real candid story, which I'm not really proud of, but I tell a lot of people about it.
To learn from.
Well, and to realize, because cops get accused of racism all the time. And the whole time I was a policeman, I knew one racist cop, one out of thousands. And he was. The guy was an out-and-out racist. But I was a rookie. I was on a job about 2 weeks, and I was badge heavy. And I had this partner who was a great guy, big guy, had worked the streets, and we were working in the Northwest section. And we pulled this guy over, and he says, you handle this. And I asked the guy for his driver's license, and he says, no. And I said, boy, you better give me that driver's license. And he cold cocked me. And we're wrestling on the ground, and my partner is just standing there. And we're wrestling. And he finally lets the guy, you know, have his way for a while. And I mean, I'm holding my own, but it wasn't a good fight. And he grabs me by the collar and grabs the guy and stands us both up. I felt like a little kid in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells the guy, get on your way. And the guy takes off. And he looks at me. He said, you learn anything from that? You called him boy? What makes you think that that's going to get you anywhere? And I said, I don't know why I said it, but I did say it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't raised, I was raised in a fairly liberal place. So it wasn't like I was racist or prejudiced against black folks.
So,
but it just came out. So he said, look, Doug, he says, here's your lesson number one. You got to be nice to everybody. And the reason why is when you're getting your ass handed to you someday in a fight, and somebody you've been nice to will be in the crowd watching it, and they'll go to the phone and drop a dime to call for help. This is before we had portable radios.
Oh, okay.
And you know, one of the worst things that could happen is those portable radios, because they can act any way they want and get as much help as they want. Mm-hmm. When you're out there with a crowd by yourself,
right?
You got problems. I started after our second riot, we started a community relations unit, and they put me in there. And we did what was called tension patrol. And this was another area that I learned to use my wits and my mouth. In the summertime in the ghettos, it gets hot, and they have calls, domestics, and, you know, three or four police cars show up. And next thing you know, a crowd shows up. And next thing you know, some rocks and bottles get thrown, and you got problems. So what we do, I had a partner by the name of Ken Phillips. He's dead now. Kenny and I drove around in an old police car in the ghetto. We weren't allowed to wear like whistles and matching pens. We were really squared away police department for uniforms back then. And he said that the chief said, look, we want you guys to be low key. Don't wear your hats and go out there. This is back in 1969. Mm-hmm. Okay? So we go out. We had a really progressive chief. He was a great guy, Leo Callahan, who was from Brockton, Massachusetts, by the way.
Okay.
And so we had a whole unit, but Kenny and I did tension patrol. So they'd get a call that required a couple of police cars. The crowds would show up. We had to go to that call and then get the officers out of there as fast as they could. And then we'd stay behind and calm the crowds down.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes it was just Kenny and me, no shotguns, no nothing, just our six shooters on our hip.
Right.
And we would be facing 100 angry people.
Yeah.
And we had to talk them down.
Mm-hmm.
And it always rested on find a commonality in the crowd, you know, try to get them to understand what went on and, you know, put your finger on their sense of justice, explain it to them. And so after a while, they would start holding their fire until we got there. And then they would confront us to what happened because we had established so much trust because we would stop and talk to people all the time. And I mean, it was a really interesting, but it taught me a lot about, you know, when you only have your mouth and your wits to protect you from getting mm-hmm. your butt handed to you, you better be nice to people.
Yeah. The other thing I heard you say earlier, too, was about establishing rapport. And that's so unique. And I don't think that is also given enough service in either training or through role modeling. Really. I mean, you had the chance to have some great people teach you how to establish rapport.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And then this last story you said was, you're coming into a volatile situation. It's a hot summer night. I'm going to say, well, in South Florida, they're all hot summer nights from about 9 months of the year. And if people are out on the street and there's no air conditioning and it's South Florida with humidity, I mean, everybody's dripping sweat and, it's not always pleasant. And then, of course, some of the boys in blue might be a little cavalier in their attitudes of, you know, shoving people into the back of police cars and what have you. And you got a crowd watching it firsthand. It's a recipe for disaster. And for you to be able to go in there and be able to take an entire mob mentality and turn it around to where they were individuals, people that could you could talk to, that's quite a thing. That was quite something else. When you first told me about after the riots, I thought you were going to tell me about how you got better at your stick practice, you know, and no, you know, you went the other way. So you must have had a progressive chief, you know? Yeah.
We had wooden nightsticks and we never carried them. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until later on in my career that they started wanting us to use them. I didn't like nightsticks. It just, I don't know. It just looked bad when you hit somebody with it. And, yeah. You know, so I remember at the academy, they said, you know, never raise your nightstick above your head because that's when the picture's going to be taken.
Yeah, that's
but,
true.
Now, even during the spring break riots and stuff, we, you know, I carried it during some of those things, but I very seldom went to a nightstick. You know, I didn't mind mixing it up and I didn't, you know, but I also, you know, hey, anything could happen when you get in a fight. So,
you're right.
But anyway, so, you know, you, like you said, you got to use your wits and, and you also have to learn to let people save face. And that's a big mistake police officers make today is because of the wartime mentality that's going on. That, you know, that a lot of them feel they're at war and, they don't, you know, they just don't know. They don't know how to let people save face. And I, when I was working for the state attorney for a short time, I had to find this witness to a murder and he was reluctant. And, I finally tracked him down. I went to where he worked at 3 a.m. He worked for a moving company and he's a great big guy. And, I said, look, you know, you really need to come in and give a statement and testify. He said, well, I don't want to. And I said, you know, this is a very serious crime. It's a murder. He said, well, what if I don't want to go? And he says it loud enough. So all his coworkers hear it. Well, they gather around me and him, right? Form like a semicircle. And a cop said, if you don't want to go, we won't let him take you. And they were getting angry, and they all had wrenches in their hands and stuff. And so he had a pickup truck, and I turned my back to the crowd, and I had him turn his back, and we're leaning into the bed of the truck. And I said, look, I said, you put me in a very bad position, because now I'm in fear for my life. And what I'm going to do is if they move on me, I'm going to shoot you. And I'll be perfectly justified. Now, I wouldn't have shot him, but I wanted him to think I would. Mm-hmm. And he said, you do that. I said, I'm not going to get killed for you. I said, you know, you don't want to put yourself out for this poor guy that got murdered. Why should I care? I'm just thinking of myself. So, yeah, I'm going to shoot you first. And I said, but here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to let you start yelling at me. You know, just really start yelling at me and tell me you don't want to go and all this stuff. And then I want you to calm down and say, all right, I'll go with you. He says, that work for you? He said, that works for me.
Wow.
So that's what he did. And I, you know, I don't know. And I learned those techniques from the people I worked with. I mean, it's not something I instinctively knew. The instinct came with the delivery, not with the knowledge. But, you know, one of my biggest mentors in law enforcement was Dave Patterson. He was my homicide sergeant. And Dave said, look, this job is fun. And always treat it like it's fun. And always treat the people you're working with and the cases you work like they're family. And you'll get along just fine. And that's what it is. The job's fun. You would have done it for free if you could have.
Oh, I know. Yeah. So, to talk a little bit about what you said there, it really is true about, and we saw this firsthand when we were both baby-faced rookies, and then we see it now 40 years later. We had a lot of returning Vietnam vets at the time, back in the 60s and the early 70s, yeah. And it really gave a militaristic view of policing, especially yeah. with all the protests and riots going on.
Oh, yeah.
It was almost as if the police had to take on I don't want to call them an occupying force, but it certainly was, you know, armed lines and shields and masks and guns. And then close your eyes 40, 50 years later, and what do you see now? Well, besides ICE, you see shields and guns and, you know, SWAT and things like that. And you have returning Middle East campaign vets, yeah. right? And they're into it for the adrenaline, coming to the police departments. And what are you seeing again? You know, it's almost the same thing.
They're wearing the same uniforms now. They're wearing military uniforms.
And, you know, and some of them are wearing military hardware as well. Thanks to the Homeland Security money. So I'm not saying that in a negative sense, but it's kind of contrary to what we both know to be a way of presenting a police force, a force of police, using the words both ways, yeah. and a way to engender a working relationship with the citizenry of which yeah. you're there to protect and to serve. And I can't help but think that you lose some of the inner city neighborhoods because of that mentality of us against them. And some of those neighborhoods say, no, we'll take care of our own problems. We don't need the police. We'll do our own thing.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
and it becomes almost vigilantism. And it doesn't matter whether it's Western Baltimore, South Side of Chicago, you know, South Central LA, Liberty City, Miami, you know, it doesn't matter. But it's all the same, basically, dynamic of a police force, use of force, stranger policing, no conversation, and just a hard-nosed attitude towards its people, you know, that they're supposed to be serving. And it's just, if I'm on my soapbox, Doug, stop me. But
No. I you know, when I was a street cop and when I was working that community relations unit, the constant and most common refrain we got from the crowd was, you're nothing but an occupying army.
Mm-hmm.
And that now that you hear that a lot now.
Sure
that,
do.
That the, and they don't understand, people don't understand. Departments are trying to address this, but what they don't understand is police departments dedicate officers to represent calls for service. And in the in some of these neighborhoods, they get more cops because there's more calls for services. And that's starting to change with some of the computerization of crime tracking.
Mm-hmm.
Where they're, and Fort Lauderdale started a program where they're doing that. And it works. But, you know, still, it's you know, it's a problem that's fed on itself for years.
Right.
And without proper community relations, you know, mm-hmm. that's why they wanted to go to community policing. But, you know, all the money was going to community policing. Every department did it and or tried to do it for some success in some places and not so much in others. And they, the 9/11 came.
Yeah.
So now the police are the tip of the spear. Terrorism and you know, so they've gone to this really militaristic look and response, and I think it's, I don't like it, but I don't blame them either. I mean, I don't know, we were getting shot at just as much back in the 60s and 70s as they are now. We didn't have as many officers killed, but there was a lot of guns out there and people didn't hesitate to take a pot shot at us.
There's a lot of guns out there today. But
yeah.
Before we move into your post-police career, I just wanted to give a shout-out to a mutual friend of ours, a guy that I worked with when I was a young baby-faced patrolman in Bluebell, Pennsylvania, and one that worked with you in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and that would be Jack King.
Oh, yeah. Great guy. Great
yeah.
guy. He yeah. was he was a go-getter, man. I haven't heard from him, and we just had a retiree's meeting, and he wasn't there in Fort Lauderdale, but he was a really good cop. He was a good detective.
Mm-hmm.
He was, and always had a smile on his face.
Yep.
You know, always smiling, and just a regular guy.
No, it's something. When you told me you were out of Fort Lauderdale PD, and I know that's where Jack went, and we made that connection, that was wonderful because he was one of my mentors. He and another officer by the name of Bob. We would work the midnight shift together in this little small town back when it was a pretty sleepy burg. And we had a lot of fun. Honestly, we had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And they taught me a lot, and they taught me what good policing was and what good investigative work looked like. Even though we were in uniform, we were still doing, you know, good investigative work. And sure enough, you know, it didn't have to be that hard ass, you know, look at you through the aviators type of attitude. It could be talking to people and just treating people like decent human beings, and you got somewhere. You know, you got some great results. So I just had to say that, you know, so many podcasts in, and we have a mutual friend.
That's funny. He's a good guy. He's really good. I'm going to reach out and see what he's doing.
And tell him I said, hey.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Now, so at some point, you continued your career in law enforcement. Just kind of walk us through that, and then tell us about your earliest days in private investigations. Or was there something in between?
No, my last 10 years before I retired, I ran an organized crime task force, and it was a multi-agency federal, state, and local task force. We only did the La Cosa Nostra. I was the director of it. In the beginning, I had a co-director, and then he went back to his agency, and I became the director. And eventually, they brought him back as my deputy director. But we just worked a mafia. That's where I got to meet Rory. We had to first of all, computers were in their infancy when we did this.
Mm-hmm.
We started, I think it was in 81. And we were so when they asked us to take over this task force to recreate it, there had been two previous task forces, and it was a result of a grand jury criticism of law enforcement going after the mob. So the state attorney tried it a third time, and they picked Kenny Staub and myself to set it up. And one of the things that we did was we wanted to be able to get a picture of who the mob was. And so we didn't have any arrest responsibilities for almost a year. And we bought a computer. I'll never forget this. It was the size of a small refrigerator and only had one meg of memory. And it was considered a beast at that time. And it cost $56,000 for the database manager, the operating system, and the machine. And we trained our people on how to use it. We put a relational database in there. And we just started feeding it with intelligence that we were gathering. And that's why I went around the country selling what we were doing. That anybody needed anything from South Florida. I even joined a group in Canada to get them going and helping us. So I did that. But as a result of that, I got on an organization called Law Enforcement Intelligence Unit. And it was a group of organized crime and narcotics investigators and executives from around the world. And I got on the board of directors of that. So I developed a reputation of, knowing how to set up systems and stuff like that. And the whole task force, which, task force are really hard to put together because you have so many personalities and culture.
Sure.
And then you have the bosses to contend with because they'll commit to a project and then 2 months later they'll want to pull their people. So as a result of that, I had started developing a national reputation for organized crime and for the processes. We took down Nicky Scarfo's crime family.
Philadelphia. Bunch.
Yeah, we started that whole investigation. The FBI came in. They were great because they had so much money and they brought some guys that were the best agents I've ever known in my life. I'm not a big fan, but these guys I would go through fire for. They were really great. Mm-hmm. We brought in your state police, Pennsylvania State Police. We brought in all sorts of agencies. We ran it for, I think it was 2.5 years, and we ended up taking down the entire Scarfo crime family. The trials were head up in Pennsylvania. Now, right. there's been books written about it, but we stayed in the background. We didn't. Most of the information on those books came from us, but we didn't publicly want any acknowledgement.
Yeah, you didn't grandstand it.
No. Yeah. So the sheriff in Broward County did. But anyway, what we did is. As a result of that, when I retired, I went to the sheriff's office for several years, and then I left there, and my wife wouldn't move. I got a job offer to go to Singapore for 5 years. Plus, I had several chief's job offers around the country, because when I worked at a sheriff's office, not only did I run his organized crime division, but I ran his road patrol, which was 1,000 deputies. We had 10 contract cities and I had 1,000 deputies on
it. Wow.
So anyway, what we did is I was lieutenant colonel there and we were getting really heavily involved in community policing. So I had a reputation for that and then for the organized crime stuff. So I started getting chief's offers and my wife at the time, my second ex-wife, wouldn't move. She wanted to stay there. And she said, I want to die in this house. I don't want to sell it and move. So I took a
that
job.
I was going to say something acerbic, but.
Well, she's my second ex-wife.
Okay.
So anyway, we had, I ended up going to work for the state attorney. He asked me to come to work for him. And Rory was always busting my chops about it.
Oh, he's good at busting chops too.
Oh yeah. He's a pro. And Rory and I got really close. So he wasn't dumb. He said, come in and do an audit of my business and come up with a plan that I can, improve my business. you know, come up with systems, the filing systems, numbering systems, marketing and stuff. So I did. And he says, you know, you need to leave the state attorney and you can take everything you recommended and put it into action. Well, you know, when you're a consultant, the last thing you want to do is hang around after your plan is, you know, and because I learned the shortcomings of my plan, because I did. I quit and I ended up going to work and was running Rory's agency for a while.
Wow.
Trying to, you know, market it, increase the caseload. He reeled me in.
Yeah.
He knew my personality. And it was a shock for a while because Rory was the chair at City College for their private investigating program. And you could get an associate's degree. And I got to tell you something, the program he put together, you could take a kid green off the street, put him through that program. He'd have an associate's degree in PI system and come out there better prepared to be a PI than a cop that got a criminal justice degree went out to be a police officer.
I don't doubt it.
And I had two kids in one class. I said, what do you want to, you know, I'd asked all the class the first, what do you want to do? And they said, well, one kid said, well, I want to be a dry cleaner. Oh, okay. And then this one kid said, well, I want to be a police officer. And his buddy said that. So I held him after class. I said, look, this is for PIs. It's a different deal. If you want to be cops, go to the junior college, get an associate's in criminal justice, get in the police academy, and you know, eventually get your bachelor's. But you're not going to be as well prepared. You're not going to know anything when you get that degree. With here, we could teach you how to be. You could hit the ground running as a PI because it was all hands-on, streetwise. You know, Rory set the program up: interviews and interrogation, report writing, criminal law, civil law, you name it. He had it in there, and surveillances. He had a really good surveillance court, and they could get jobs right away and be qualified, you know, not to do complex cases, but to be good employees that are new at the job.
So, and have some confidence and have a career trajectory.
Yeah. In fact, one of my students, we became partners out in Texas when I was in Texas.
Okay.
So, years later, 20 years later. Yeah.
Wow.
So anyway, I ended up doing that with Rory and I ended up going out on my own, but I always stayed close to Rory and, mm-hmm. Because I was doing consulting also. I have an expertise in terrorism and counterterrorism and terrorism philosophy. I used to teach it at the police academy and I had a lot of experience with extremist groups when I ran the intelligence unit. So, you know, I had other things I was doing besides, investigating, but then eventually the, PI stuff started, kicking in.
Okay. Now, at some point, you made a move out to Austin, Texas?
Yeah. I had stage 4 throat cancer.
And, oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
That was back in 2010, and I went in remission in 2011. And I did some cases in Texas, and I always liked Texas. And so I hooked up with that former student of mine. He had done some work for Rory and I in Fort Lauderdale.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. But I don't know how this happened, but I ended up getting cases all over the country and some places in Europe. And I don't know why that, but I traveled all the time. So it didn't really matter where I lived because I still had contacts in Fort Lauderdale.
Mm-hmm.
I had contacts all over the country and in Canada. I mean, so I'd get calls, you know, and it always seemed that I had a contact, like if it was in the state of California. Well, I know somebody out there. I can hook us up and we can do, you know, we can mm-hmm. do a lot of work. And so I'd always call Rory. Who do you got in Nelly out there? And he'd tell me, and I'd call that person and we'd team up with them and I'd go out there and we'd work it. And there were some guys, some retired FBI agents out in San Diego that used to use me all the time in Fort Lauderdale. So it's just one of those things. And I fell in love with Texas, man. I just loved it.
And just to for our listeners, NALI, the National Association of Legal Investigators. Yeah.
Great organization.
Yeah.
Great
organization. I'm still a member.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I never joined those groups, and I'll tell you why. I have this nasty habit. When I get involved in organizations, I end up wanting to get on the board or, you know, do something more.
To fix them.
To help
them.
The organization. Yeah. Yeah. It's just strange. And I knew I didn't have time or the resources to do it. So I just never did it. Rory gets a lot of cases because of his affiliation with.
Sure.
With those groups. So.
No, it's a good organization. When when my business changed from primarily insurance fraud investigation to becoming a generalist private investigator working in the southern New England area, I joined NALI to learn about private investigations, because I had been at that point, you know, besides being a police officer, I was a one trick pony with insurance fraud. And when that door closed for me, on me, in my face, I had to find out, I had to find another way to make a living and, you know, keep paying the bills. And I reached out to an organization that showed to me at the time, and still does, a high level, a caliber of investigators working for it that could show you what other types of investigative work was that you could make a living at. And I learned a lot.
And that's important because, as you know, there's different levels of private investigator.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have your kind of guys that like to wear dark trench coats. And then you got your people that, you know, they're just looking for a retirement job or something, and they do a good job, but you know, they're not real motivated. And then you have your top tier guys.
Well, there's also one small group in there that, you know, I kind of look at too, and they kind of remind me of some beefy muscled street cops, and those are the repo bond enforcement guys, and they, you know, they tend to be rough and ready, if you know what I'm saying. I'm not being mean. I'm just saying
they're action oriented, and they want to get into that bail skipping thing and repo. And that's fine. But I want to know, because I had a really good client base, and I was really motivated for results. And, you know, even when they'd get an alley guy, I'd call him and talk to him or her, and I'd, you know, kind of feel them out to make sure that actually we're on the same level.
Sure.
Because I tell people, I don't look good in orange, and I'm not going to break the rule. You know, I might stretch a few, but I'm not going to break any.
I understand.
And it's, you know, a lot of times you're in a jurisdiction where you don't have any friends. And
no, I know, but lately I've been catching these Facebook feeds of guys that are doing fugitive takedowns and repos that have a little bit of macho tough guy stuff going on, and I see it, I understand it, but does it really represent our profession in the best possible light?
No, we got a lot of we have a lot of mud on our face from some of our brothers that a lot of the media portrays don't always have a positive view of private investigators.
Oh no,
you're fighting that. And what I try to do is when I tell people I'm a private investigator, I try to be as professional as I can and try to look more like a I'm a detective, but I'm also a professional. And you have to, like Danny, my partner in Texas, he wears a suit everywhere. It could be 110 degrees and he's got a suit on.
Really?
He always asks me, are you going to wear a suit today? Because a lot of times I wouldn't. And I always have I'm kind of a preppy looking guy, so I'll have a, button down shirt, starched and nice pants and stuff. But if it's 100 degrees out, I don't want to be wearing a jacket. Danny would show up with a 3-piece suit. We did a case in Louisiana. This was the funniest thing. I can't get into the particulars, but we had to get information on this kid at a high school he was in Louisiana. And the high school had a disciplinary school that they sent all the bad eggs to. And we show up at the school. Somebody, a police chief in Louisiana, pointed us to a guy at the school. And we pull up and we're dressed in suits and it's 100 degrees out in Louisiana. And he automatically assumed we were the FBI.
Absolutely. That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah. And we didn't say, we just said we're private investigators. Hey, so I thought you were the FBI. I said, no. So we were talking to him, really nice guy. He goes, look, I got a class of eighth graders here that need some talking to. Everybody thinks you're the FBI. Don't disabuse them of that, but go in there and read them the riot act. So we did, you know, and he just loved it. And, we come out and he hands us the file. And he said, yeah, don't worry about it. No law in Louisiana governs that thing. So it was pretty interesting, but it all was based on how we presented ourselves.
We're going to end this portion of the interview with Doug at this time. Next week, we will pick up with Doug with some more of his best stories. Thank you for listening, and I hope I've earned your interest and your time. Please leave any comments on the website, www.johnhoda.com. That's JohnHoda.com. Look forward to part two of our interview with Doug Haas next week. Thanks a lot. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you've enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear other great detective stories, please go to johnhoda.com and click on the podcast page. There you will find the backlist. Now, you're probably asking, John, what about your own stories? Do you have any? Sure enough, I do. And they're available for you free with your email subscription to the podcast as a download right to your inbox. I have 8 short stories and 8 vignettes from my book titled Mugshots, My Favorite Detective Stories. Now, here is my ask. If you were informed, inspired, and entertained by the stories today, don't be bashful. Please take a moment to share this podcast with your friends, then leave a review on your favorite podcatcher. If you like to leave a comment, you can do so on the website at www.johnhoda.com. That's JohnHoda.com. Thank you so much and have a great day.